Well, I spent a couple hours trying to develop a topic and realized it wasn't happening. But Sunday, whenever we didn't have church, I put about another 10 hours in John 6. And I have some more information. So John 6 may become the new Romans 8. I don't know. Romans 14 or whatever. But I realized that there were some questions that I hadn't answered to my satisfaction. Still were questions in my mind that I wanted to look at. And so that's what I'm prepared for. What kind of questions? Well, we've looked extensively at verse 44 about the drawing of God. Talked about how, in fact, God does draw us to himself by many ways. But in that discussion Jesus has with the Jews there, there's another verse which sort of is puzzling. And maybe more than one, but anyway, this is another one that I wanted to work on, and it is introduced in verse 37, where he says, "All that the Father giveth me shall come to me, and him that cometh to me I will in no wise cast out." Okay, so another kind of verse which lends itself to Calvinistic thinking, if you're so inclined. And so I wanted to look at that. In the process, I found a lot of other things. First of all, I want to point out how that in John, Jesus uses verb tense in ways that are odd to us. Now, we noted already that in verse 44, if we're going to understand Jesus to be saying, no man can come to where I will be, then it's odd for him to say, no man can come to me in the present tense. But in fact, when you start looking, you find that his usage of tense often departs from our expectations. The other two passages here where he uses this language are the first examples. So in John 7, verses 33 and 34, Jesus says, "Yet a little while am I with you, and then I go unto him that sent me. Ye shall seek me, and shall not find me. And where I am, thither ye cannot come." I am is present tense. The shall seek me is in the future. So here again, we might have expected that where I will be, you cannot come. But it is a present tense I am. In John chapter 8, verse 21, the other instance of the cannot come to me language, he says, "I go my way," and that's present tense, "ye shall seek me, and shall die in your sins," future tense, "whether I go," present tense, "ye cannot come." So, an odd use of tenses from our point of view. A couple other examples that we haven't noted yet. Later in this chapter, in verse 58, in his discussion with the Jews about Abraham and his relationship to him, he very famously says that before Abraham was, I am. Okay, the great I am, right? And once again, a present tense, not before Abraham was, I was, before Abraham was, I am. And another one I came across is in John 17. In his high priestly prayer, as we typically label it, in verse 11 of this chapter, Jesus says, And now I am no more in the world, but these are in the world. And I come to thee, Holy Father, keep through thine own name those whom thou hast given me, that they may be one as we are. And once again, we would say, well, Jesus, hang on. You are still in the world as we see it. You haven't ascended into heaven yet. You haven't even been crucified yet. And yet we have this language. And so my point is this. This is apparently the way Jesus spoke of himself. And so we shouldn't be surprised if you have a verse like 44, where he is actually referring to not the present tense, not whether you can come to me in salvation, but to whether you can come to where I am eternally here on this earth for a very short period. So I wanted to fill out that picture. And next, I would like to look at the language that I noted there in verse 37, I believe it was, of John 6.
Would you say, in a sense, Jesus is talking about himself this way because he's as God outside of time? There is not future or past. I mean, is that connected to that idea?
I guess it'd be hard for me to speculate on why he did it. That certainly appeals to our sense of reason, that might be the case. But at any rate, it's something you have to be sensitive to when you're understanding the things that he said, that may be going on, since we see places where it clearly is going on. So, I want to point out something else that's going on here with the crowd of Jews in this passage, which is revealed by the nature of the conversation. Remember when they found him, they said, when did you come here? And Jesus says, verily, verily, I say unto you, ye seek me not because ye saw the miracles, but because ye did eat of the loaves and were filled. Now, most people wouldn't consider that to be a very kind thing to say. But, on the other hand, it expresses, as we begin to see, a truth that points to the heart of where they are. They didn't believe in him. They weren't even all that impressed by the miracle. Okay? And we'll see that here in a minute. And so he's pointing out the fact that you're not here because you believe in me. You're here because you like the food. And of course, you have motivations. You're wanting to use my life. But that sort of sets the stage for the interaction here. He then admonishes them, don't work for the meat that perisheth, but for that meat which endureth unto everlasting life, which the Son of Man shall give unto you, for him hath the Father sealed. And then they said unto him, what shall we do that we might work the works of God? Okay, so they're going to play along here for a bit. And what kind of answer do you think they might be looking for in this? What form is this question? That is, given who these people are, what kind of question is this?
Is the works there the same thing as miracles in 26?
No.
Okay. I'm trying to remember. Was there something where he said, do the works? And then they were responding with this question, what do we do to work the works
This is the question that they responded with whenever he said, labor not for the meat. So labor is the same word as work in the next verse. So they're keying off of his word, but it's labor. Okay, so do you understand my question? No? Okay. Well, maybe it wasn't a good question. But it was a question that was trying to get you to think with me. And so it was a good question. Let's see if I can ask it in a different way. You know, if you say certain, if you bring up certain topics with people, because of their background and focus, instantly they think in certain terms, right? So if you bring up religion, depending on what your background is, you think in certain terms. If you bring up to the Jews, what are the works of God, what framework are they going to analyze that whole question in terms of?
The law.
The law. Yeah. But they're wanting to, you know, this is kind of similar to saying, what is the greatest law? What is the work that God wants us to do, that we're to do? So it's, they're thinking in terms of, what are you going to tell us from the law? What amazing interpretation of the law are you going to give us at this point? They're not asking him how he did his miracle, because they're not even acknowledging that he did a miracle, as we'll soon see. So it's not like, how did you do that? You said do the works of God. Well, what are the works of God? Jesus said unto them, this is the work of God, that you believe on him whom he hath sent. They said therefore unto him, what sign showest thou then that we may see and believe thee? And this is actually sarcastic. What is it you do? What do you do? What work do you do? So, you know from that they're not trying to understand his miracle, because they didn't perceive it as something that proved who he was. And I don't know if you remember what follows down here, but do you know why it is they might have not been impressed by his miracle of the multiplication of the bread, being Jews?
Bread coming from heaven?
Well, Moses did that too. We've seen this done. We've got somebody in our background, in our family, that does that, did it for years, 40 years. So, I mean, for real, that's what they say here. So it's important to know where they're at in their minds. Now, just as a little sideline here, one reason I know Jesus wasn't a Calvinist. And I got to come up with at least 7 of these at some point in my life. But anyway, one of them I know for sure is that Jesus taught salvation by works. It's right here. Then said they unto him, what shall we do that we might work the works of God? Jesus said, this is the work of God, that you believe on him whom he hath sent. So believing on him whom he hath sent is a work. Jesus said so. It's not easy, it's hard. It's something you have to do. Tongue-in-cheek a little bit. But if you want to push proof texts, in fact, Jesus is not a Calvinist. And he's not overly sensitive to that allergy to using the word work. There are things for us to do. Anyway, that was free. That was. It did just sort of hit me when I wasn't expecting it. It's like, oh my goodness. I wasn't looking for that. There it is. Okay, so what we're wanting to see here, okay, we're getting down to verse 37. And so they ask him, what kind of sign are you going to show us? They didn't take his miracle as a sign of enough significance to believe on him. And they just drop some names here. Our fathers did eat manna in the desert. As it is written, he gave them bread from heaven. Well, Jesus is a little sensitive about that particular approach. He says, actually, Moses didn't give you any bread from heaven. My Father giveth you the true bread. For the bread of God is he that cometh down from heaven and giveth life unto the world. And they said, Lord, evermore give us this bread. We'll try it. And Jesus said unto them, I am the bread of life. He that cometh to me shall never hunger. He that believeth on me shall never thirst. But I said unto you that ye also have seen me and believe not. Now, verse 36 is a bit of a puzzle to most all commentators and readers. If you ask yourself, okay, now where did Jesus say that? That ye have seen me and believe not. Because in fact, that exact quote doesn't occur anywhere in John. But fortunately, we already know that our sensitivity to exact quotes isn't always reflected in Jesus and his sayings. Because in verse 44, we have that statement about, if the Father draw you, except the Father draw you, no man can come to me. And he quotes that in verse 65. And there he says, therefore I said unto you that no man can come unto me except it were given him of my Father. And with our Western logic and way of thinking and grading papers, we would get very low grades for saying that was a quote, wouldn't we? Because it's not a quote. It's not exactly the same thing. But it means the same thing. And so in this other verse, then, you have seen me and believe not. I said that unto you. And the me is bracketed in some translations because it wasn't in all the manuscripts. So it, if it helps any, you have seen and believe not. Because they were asking to see a sign.
And they were looking at him right there. He was the sign.
But they had also seen a sign. And so if we go back up to verse 26, Jesus said what we've already read, ye seek me not because ye saw the miracles, but because you did eat of the loaves and were filled. And that's probably the closest thing we have in substance to what Jesus said he had told them in verse 26. You saw, but you didn't believe in me. You were just attracted to the food. You rejected that sign as an indication of who I was. Okay, so we're working up to verse 36, or 37. You also have seen me and believe not. Then he says, all that the Father giveth me shall come to me, and him that cometh to me I will in no wise cast out. For I came down from heaven not to do mine own will, but the will of him that sent me. And this is the Father's will, which hath sent me, that of all which he hath given me, I should lose nothing, but should raise it up again at the last day. And this is the will of him that sent me, that everyone which seeth the Son and believeth on him may have everlasting life, and I will raise him up at the last day. Okay, so there's kind of a curious relationship between those verses. 39 and 40 are very similar, except that in 39 we have the phrase, this is the Father's will, that all that he hath given me, I should lose nothing, but should lose it, but should raise it up again at the last day. And 40 says, and this is the will of him that sent me, which is clearly the Father, that everyone which seeth the Son and believeth on him may have everlasting life. What about this odd expression, all that the Father has given me? Well, if we look around for where Jesus uses this expression, we find that it occurs several times, once again, in chapter 17 of John. And I did read some other chapters, by the way. It's just that there's a lot of things to find in chapter 17. First of all, in verse 6 of chapter 17, we have this. Jesus says, I have manifested thy name unto the men which thou gavest me out of the world. Thine they were, and thou gavest them me, and they have kept thy word. Okay, so that has a similar feel, the men which thou gavest me out of the world. In verse 9, we have this. He says, I pray for them, I pray not for the world, but for them which thou hast given me, for they are thine. Who's he talking about here?
Disciples.
The disciples. Clearly.
The 12 or 11 or whatever, or followers.
Apparently the closest, and we'll have an indication of that in a minute.
Okay.
Another thing that he says, who he had in mind more clearly. Verse 11 and 12, he says, and now I am no more in the world, but these are in the world, and I come to thee. Holy Father, keep through thine own name those whom thou hast given me, that they may be one as we are. While I was in the world, I kept them in thy name. Those that thou gavest to me I kept, and none of them is lost but the son of perdition, that the scripture might be fulfilled. So it was the 12 that were with him at this occasion in the upper room when he was praying. And that verse in particular seems to identify clearly that that's who he's talking about. And so we see multiple places here that Jesus uses this expression about his disciples, those whom thou hast given me. Now, why might he have done that? That seems unexpected, shall we say. In what sense did God give the disciples to Jesus? Savannah? Well, that's fine. I think I can come back there without forgetting.
What does perdition mean?
Okay. Perdition means destruction. I think it is probably the same word as perish in other places.
Okay.
The son of destruction. It's a way of referring to the end of Judas. Yes. Okay, so thinking now about why Jesus might have referred to this, I think probably you can readily relate, if you happen to be a parent, to the sense in which your children have been given to you. Whenever a child comes into this world, you really have no idea what you're getting, right? That was true of me, too. So, they are placed in your hands, under your care, under your influence. And the influence you exert on them has a huge impact on them. It's not the only influence, but it's a huge one. And so, I think Jesus looked at the disciples in that same way as we tend to look at our children. You have brought them into my life. You have placed them in my life. You have, in that sense, given them to me. They've been under my influence. They've had special access to me and what I have to give and to say. And so, even though you might not have expected him to use that kind of language, he he does. And that's the way he thinks about it. And he distinguishes between these and everybody else. He says, I'm praying for these on this matter. And then he prays for others as well. For instance, in verse 20, a verse which I'm very thankful for, he says, neither pray I for these alone, but for them also which shall believe on me through their word. Notice the what should be, if you are a Calvinist, the peculiar lack of any drawing language here. Not, I pray for those whom you will draw, but I pray for those who will believe on me through their word. It is the testimony of the disciples on which the whole Christian enterprise is based, ultimately. We wouldn't know about Jesus if we didn't have the record, the witness of their lives. It is through their word that we believe. And so that speaks volumes to me about what it is Jesus is thinking in terms of how this all works. And it also helps me understand his language then in chapter 6, where he has his disciples gathered around him. And you can imagine, to some degree, the kind of talk that might have been going on in Galilee among the folks about these guys that had left their jobs and left their families and followed Jesus. It's like, we'll see how this works out, right? See what's going to happen here. There was a special, I think, stake in things that Jesus wanted to comment on, that the ones that have come under my influence, I'm going to take care of. The ones who have believed on me in a special way, I'm going to see that they are delivered to the finish line. So you understand the reason why he might have singled them out. And so then in that progression of verses that we just read back in chapter 6, where to start with he talks about the ones that you have given me, and we broaden the picture, just as he did in chapter 17, I pray for these, but not for these alone. Here's his comment about these that he has given me. But this is the will of him that sent me, that everyone which seeth the Son and believeth on him may have everlasting life, and I will raise him up at the last day. Okay. So I don't find that language of those that he hath given me all that puzzling when I look carefully at how Jesus uses it in other places. I didn't expect it. And so if this is all I read, the danger of reading just one or two verses, if this is all I read, it's like, oh, some people God is giving to Jesus and some he's not. I hope I'm one of those. Right? Well, you're not, okay? Because the ones that he gave to Jesus are long gone. He's talking about the 12 there, as is clear from the verses of chapter 17. But the good news is, it's not for these alone, but for all those who will believe on his name through their word. Okay, so that was a major problem for me that I spent some time on.